China's plan has been in place for a very, very long time, to become the world global penultimate industrial superpower. In a fifth generational warfare context, the ideal is the target has no idea they're at war. That's largely what's been happening to us. They have weaponized our own economic model against us where we are no longer necessary. And by 2049, they want absolute control of the whole system. Structurally, the system is so flawed, we know a crash is coming. Fiat currency is not the problem. It's the people who are entrusted to administer it break the rules. We think the world has worked a certain way, but the actual power structures have been completely different in the background. And those power structures are being destroyed at the moment. The prepper community could represent the part of society that will ensure a civilized society survives. The people who take this on will have to understand that they will dedicate their lives to something that they may never see.
World War III is already happening.
This is a house of cards, and it is in the process of collapsing right now.
You're going to see an economic crash the likes of which we've never seen.
Hi, folks. Canadian Prepper here. Today's guest is Dr. Simon Michaud. He's a geologist and systems thinker with the Geological Survey of Finland. He's known for his groundbreaking work on the limits of the energy transition, arguing that our current industrial systems can't be sustained by renewable energy alone due to raw material constraints. His thesis, energy, not money, is the true driver of civilization, and we're heading potentially for a major day of reckoning. What is your high-level stratospheric analysis of what's happening in the world? And maybe we could anchor it in what's going on right now with the trade wars, the decoupling. You could talk a little bit perhaps about material scarcity and how that factors into increased levels of conflict.
I believe the current set of circumstances has been known for a long time, for some decades. It's been known, for example, it's 2025, everything's gone batshit crazy. And a lot of the people around me are going, oh, we are so surprised. Right, but energy is the underlying paradigm that actually dictates terms and what technology we can actually use, and that dictates terms on how society runs. Right, like it's not just energy on its own, but what do we do with it? And so access to things like technology, can I get a new car? Will my phone work? And will the system behind the phone work? And so it's you have a system, and that's how I like to think. I started out with the idea of peak oil and how that's going to change everything, and how, you know, society is going to go through this transformation or a metamorphosis. And because most of us are not prepared to deal with that, we're going to do it the hard way.
Can you maybe break down the misconceptions about peak oil? Because right now we're seeing oil crater. We're seeing the OPEC start to open the spigot once again, despite Middle Eastern war concerns, despite Russia's oil refineries being bombarded on a daily basis, the price of oil is still down for some reason. Perhaps you can summarize peak oil and why it's still a thing for our audience.
Peak oil in its original form was the idea that oil extraction would follow, in terms of production over time, a bell curve. Production would go up and up and up and up, and it would peak in terms of what was being brought to the market, and there'll come a point where it starts to decline. This is the idea put forward by Marion King Hubbert. And he predicted very successfully oil in the United States market. Okay, so Hubbert put forward an idea that was very interesting. He did not have all the information, and he did not have leads on technology, for example, to go out and find more oil deep in the ocean. That was well and truly beyond what he had at the time. He also had no understanding of the fracking tight oil sector, and that behaves very differently. In fact, Art Berman's put together some very nice work at the moment to show that what we call oil extraction is not going the way we think, and we should perhaps have a look at what we call peak oil and what does it mean. And so in a systems context, I've got like a series of things that interact with each other. So peak oil on its own is not enough, and it's too simplistic. It needs to be connected to other things. Right, so around 2005, conventional oil plateaued, and it stayed on a bumpy plateau since then. I make the case that in January 2005, conventional oil plateaued as a consequence of the Iraq War. The second Iraq War where 4.2 million barrels a day were taken offline. That was the Iraqi sector. Saudi Arabia was told and tried to open the spigots and bring in as much production as they could. They increased a bit, but they hit a point where they couldn't go any further. And oil plateaued. Right, so, and even the Saudis then went out and brought on an enormous number of new rigs online to get more capacity. And so they actually had a 4% decline with 140% increase in rig count across those couple of years. So what that meant was the Saudis had actually reached the limit of what they had operational at the time. Since then they sweated out more production, and they were able to go up a few years later. And since then, they have now peaked and declined. Now, I make the case that while that plateaued, demand wanted to keep going up because that's what happens. For a short period of time, supply and demand separated, and that created a bubble. Like a speculative bubble in the oil price. And if you remember in 2008, the oil price peaked around, and it peaked at something stupid, like 100, was it $149? It depends if you adjust mm-hmm. for inflation or not, of course. But that peak was the temporal marker for the start of the global financial crisis.
Mm.
When you actually look at the metal price, though, I've got this nice chart that shows that January 2005, there's a blowout in the price of metals, base metals, precious metals, oil, gas, and coal, as well as fertilizer minerals. They all blow out January 2005. So I think oil plateaued, and that's like the hemoglobin of our system, and that put the rest of the system under strain. That strain got to a certain point, and the weakest link broke, which happened to be the US subprime market. And the global financial crisis kicked off. So the GFC was the blowout point of a stress strain window. What then happened is two things. Fracking, an evolution in the fracking industry with horizontal drilling became widespread, and that took off, and then that has been where most of our new oil production has come from since then. What also happened was they started printing money like never before. Now, when you actually look at the chart now, here we are in 2025. How much money has been printed and over what time? That's very interesting. When oil, conventional oil peaks, when we had the GFC, everything blew up. Since then, we've printed something like $30 trillion in the United States. And then every nation state around the world has done the same thing. So what we called the plateauing of oil production triggered the predative, the quantitative easing era. Now here we are. So the system's been trying to thermodynamically correct since 1970, and we keep preventing it from doing so. Kicking the can down the road. So there'll come a point when the system fragments. Now, in system dynamics, when a system's put under stress, if the normal checks and balances are taken away, the system can actually keep going with higher stress inherent in it, but when it finally breaks, it will shatter into very small pieces because the normal checks and balances have not stepped in to prevent more stress entering the system. That's the situation we're in. That was the situation we were in 2008. If they didn't stop the hemorrhaging of credit, and I think we got to 5 or 6 hours of the banking system being in paralysis, full paralysis. So it was quite serious. But that would have been the point where it would have just fragmented to bits. So it's not a question of they did the wrong thing in 2008. But the wrong thing was done a long time ago.
So how does the money printing affect the shale production? Like, what is the relationship?
So the printing of money means it gave us, even though it's fiat, even though it's like numbers on a screen, we ran up a credit card debt. And it allowed us to spend money on things that we didn't have. So we could then go and develop this massive, like the shale oil sector is this engineering marvel. The amount of infrastructure behind the shale industry in the United States is huge. It is enormous. It's not just the drilling rigs, it's the pipes, it's the refinery. The printing of money allowed us to develop all that. And then it allowed us to take off the balance sheet a whole lot of costs that we normally would have had to pay full price for. We'll pay off our credit card later.
All right, guys. So as some of you know, Canadian Prepper is a fully independent channel. We don't have sponsors and we're beholden to nobody. You can help support us by supporting yourself by gearing up at CanadianPreparedness.com. I know that in an emergency, having the right gear can make all the difference. This is why I've tested and curated the best preparedness products on the market so that you can be confident and ready for whatever comes your way. Now, back to the video. And so, when is oil going to run out, and when is that supply constraint going to have some like material outcome in the price? Because, you know, as people, we kind of look at the packaging of things, and in order for our viewers to maybe grasp the gravity of the situation and have something to wrap their heads around, when will oil effectively, when will we start seeing that reflected in the price of oil?
So things have changed, right? So then we get to November 2018. We do see a peak, and at the moment this is peak oil, of what we call crude oil. So I published a report in 2019 about the oil industry, and I found that most, with only one or two exceptions, times that we had gone to war in the West had been in a place where either oil was in the ground, and we either had a kinetic war or we had an economic sanction war. Sanctions were applied against Russia and Venezuela, and there were very few exceptions. But all that stopped in 2018. And what I think it was who controls the oil market as we get to the point of peak oil. Now, peak oil, let's say peak oil really was November 2018. But this is Art Berman's excellent analysis come to the fore. What we call peak oil now has to change. We used to think in terms of oil gives us gasoline, which we put in cars, and that drives the whole economy. We're now getting gasoline from other sectors. They're now getting gasoline from biofuels, but they're also getting gasoline from what's called natural gas liquids, which comes from the gas industry. And we've got plenty of gas. Like gas is also a finite thing, but that peak gas is going to be something like 2035. So we're propping up the oil industry from other sectors now. So in terms of demand, we are able to supply demand from the other sectors. So conventional peak oil now needs to be scrapped, and a new theory needs to be put in its place. And that's Art Berman's contribution. In fact, I think he put an analysis out, and that's the temporal marker for us to actually start thinking in those terms.
So what is that thesis that Art Berman proposed, for people who don't know?
Okay, so Art had he's an oil industry professional.
Yeah.
He's got his hands on the actual moving parts of the oil industry in the United States, whereas people like me are sitting on the other side of the world looking at, you know, like data patterns. He made the observation that the fracking oil sector is proving much more resilient than we thought. The original thought was when you have a fracked well, it peaks and declines, and 36 months after it's drilled, it's dropped something like 80% in production or 90% in production. Hmm. That's an individual well, but when you've actually got like a network of wells together, they collaborate together so that the production of the field tends to go up and then plateau, and the plateau is longer than the conventional bell curve.
Mm.
So we're actually getting more oil out of these plays than we thought. Okay. And so he was saying, like, since Trump has come in and they're opening up all the areas that were previously restricted, you know, drill baby drill, there's now more oil production coming online in the United States. But the rest of the world is declining. So now we've got the idea, you know, now that we've got the world idea of tariffs, we've got regions. And what's happening in the United States at the moment is very interesting, where the implications of the tariffs suggest an entirely new economic order going forward. We can talk about that in a moment. But so you've got the idea that more capacity is coming online. A study done by HSBC Bank in 2016 came to the conclusion that 80% of existing oil reserves that were producing were in decline at between 5 and 15% a year. So all the conventional stuff is declining, but the US sector might be able to pull out a Hail Mary and keep going for a bit, But the question is, what if the US sector does not supply the rest of the world anymore and keeps all that production domestically? Which,
It appears we're on track for that.
and so what does that mean? And so we've got I've been studying, for example, the Chinese system. What are the Chinese up to? And then what is the US up to? And Europe, it had a plan too, but they decided they couldn't agree on the color of an orange and they all crashed. I believe the BRICS economies is a plan. Anyway, we're getting off track. Maybe we can come back to that later. Right. So what we call, and what Art also said that is we're getting gasoline, like something like 45% of gasoline produced in the United States is coming from the natural gas liquid sector. So now it's an inefficiency in the gas industry. It's an industry that spent decades trying to become efficient, but now we're forcing an inefficiency in to prop up the gasoline sector. The problem is we can't make all the heavier fuels like diesel fuel, and that's going to be the trouble. So the military machine runs on jet fuel, even the tanks, right? But the civilian sector runs on diesel fuel. Now look up on YouTube, Art Berman, "The Devil Is in the Diesel."
Yes, I've seen the podcast. I think is that one with Higgins
Nate.
or
Yes, Nate
yeah,
Higgins. Yes.
right.
But so even though these things are relatively abstract, these are the moving parts several layers down.
So just to clarify then, because people can kind of sink their teeth into that, diesel is running out because oil is running out, and you can't make diesel from natural gas derivatives.
Correct.
Okay. And
Right.
diesel is
So
what the global supply chain
civilian.
runs on.
Yes, Alice Friedman wrote a book, When Trucks Stop. And she sort of spells out like what happens if we take trucks offline without thinking about what trucks do for us. The answer is a lot. So, yeah. Now, also biofuels are being used more and more and more. So these things are, I call them the bullets on a Band-Aid wound. No, sorry. Band-Aid on a bullet wound, as in it's a good temporary measure until they pull another rabbit out of the hat. What they call peak oil, though, means we're not running out of oil. We've got half of the oil we've ever discovered, right? So we've got a lot of oil left. Now, the
Right.
second half, though, happens to be the hard to get oil. And then once we get it, we've got to do more to process it to make it useful. So it's the expensive half. Now, we don't run out of oil. We run out of money and our ability to access that oil. That's the problem.
So isn't
Now, the
money just
rest.
an abstract thing, though? Like, isn't, as
To a
long as the
point.
material resource is there, isn't there? I mean, obviously it's finite, but what is the ROI difference now versus back in the Jebediah shooting the ground in Texas days when the oil just,
That's a great way of putting it. Right. So when oil was first discovered in Pennsylvania, I don't know if it was discovered, but the first famous discovery when they had like the big gushers shooting up into the air, it was very, very high quality oil. And they say roughly at the time, for every unit of energy you put in, you got 100 back. But there are examples of 500 to one. Right. They were very unusual examples when we first found. Now, oil now, conventional oil is somewhere between 12 and 20 to 1, depending on which analyst you talk to. It's something around that. So we're, and what's happening there is we've got to drill much, much, much deeper. Well, in the day, we used to drill a hole that may be 100 feet deep, and then oil would, under its own accord, would gush into the air, and you'd catch it in a barrel. And I think with only one basic filtering step, you could put it straight in your car. And to make petroleum was only one or two steps. Now you've got to either drill many, 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 many thousand feet into the earth, get the stuff. You've got to find it to start with, then get it up to the surface. It tends to be full of sulfur, and you've got to put it into a refinery with many, many distillation steps to clean the sulfur out. And then you've got all these refining steps. Then you get your gasoline, and then you get your diesel and all the other products like asphalt and propane and kerosene and all that. You've also got the offshore oil where they go out into the ocean. And I'm talking in terms of feet, like 10,000 water, 10,000 feet deep, like 2 or 3 kilometers deep. Then they get down to the ocean floor and they've got to drill a further 10,000 feet into the sea floor, then find the oil, then get it up to the surface and then process it. It all costs money. Right. So we're not running out of oil. It's just harder to get hold of. So now let's go to another layer up in the system and money. Now, the way our money system was centuries ago, money was money. You had a physical unit. But in 1913, the US Federal Reserve was formed. And they had the idea of fractional reserve banking, where every bank could hold, you only had to hold like 10% of your portfolio, and you could lend out the rest. And it was a way of creating the money supply. And so at that point, our financial system became an illusion. It was based on a set of rules that were regularly broken. And this is the problem. Fiat currency on it in its own right is not the problem. It's the people who are entrusted to administer it break the rules for their own benefit in a sustained fashion over time, and the whole thing goes off the rails. And the ability for that to happen while the people on the ground have no idea what's happening, that's what creates these crashes and why every single fiat currency system so far has crashed, no exceptions.
So in a similar way that you have the rapaciousness of greed and money printing, you have this like as we got off the gold standard, the understanding, this disconnect with the reality of the oil scarcity kind of emerges because we just assume that it's infinite. We assume that money is infinite, even though the fundamentals. Can you maybe elaborate on this relationship between getting off the gold standard and energy consumption and why it's unsustainable?
Okay, so there is a money, what we call money is joined at the hip with oil. So back in 1944, the United States was essentially where China is now. They represented about half, at the time, half of the global industrial system, and they had about half the global gold reserves. And the rest of the world had just been through a war, which had destroyed things. So the American system was penultimate. They had what was called the Bretton Woods Agreement, where the United States was recognized as the world currency, the world reserve currency. And to be frank, that was fair because at the time, the United States had essentially resolved World War II. The Russians did most of the fighting, but they were absolutely devastated. There was nothing left. But the Americans had this massive industry and they were economically intact and they weren't damaged at all, really. So it ethics aside, it wasn't unreasonable. When you look at the terms of history, like over hundreds of years, it was them basically saying, we will now form an empire. And if you look in terms of power dynamics, one of my books, my bookcase here, this, The 48 Laws of Power. Right,
Yep, Robert
this
Greene.
applied to history. You see it again and again and again. We're seeing it now. So they had what was called the Bretton Woods Agreement. And so what that was, the US dollar became the global currency, and US dollars were exchanged for gold reserves in many countries around the world. Especially Europeans, the French, for example, get handed over massive chunks of their treasury in safekeeping for the Americans, so the Americans would run the world reserve system. Unfortunately, the American administration at the time did not balance the books. They did not run an appropriate budget. So they kept spending more money than they had. And so we'll just print more money. So the idea of printing money has been around for a while. Remember, the banking sector in the background is inventing more money on a daily basis. When you go to get a loan at a bank, you say, oh, I want a loan, here's my collateral. They'll take that
Right.
and they'll just put some numbers on the screen and here it is and you're away. So the whole system was expanding greatly in fraudulent terms. Fraudulent made legal. Right. So wind the clock forward to about 1969, 1970, and it was apparent that the American system was overheated and overbalanced. They were not far off being insolvent. Other nation states were aware of this state of affairs, and they go, look, this is not good. But because the Americans were the oil pump of the world, like they were pumping oil, they were the primary oil producer of the world. The French basically were the first to step up and say, we want our gold back. And they demanded their gold back. But in doing so, it was apparent that if this happened too many times, the American system would be insolvent and be forced into bankruptcy. Before they got to that point, they said, we need to go off the gold standard. And they decoupled. And they did that to prevent... it was essentially 2008, but in a different form. The system was about to explode. You know, they would have been forced into a reset. If they were to do things properly, all their bullshit was about to be called. And then they would force over, so this is our real system, and they would have to correct back to what their true net position would have been. To prevent that from happening, they went off the gold standard so they could avoid that. At the same time, the United States peaked in its oil production. And oil was the fundamental energy. Oil was the fundamental energy source that ran most of the world at the time, and the Americans were the supporting system that allowed it to happen. Right. So, so in 1971, they decoupled from the gold standard around the same time that the oil production in the Americans peaked and they couldn't bring it to the market. However, they pulled a rabbit out of the hat, a Hail Mary. 1973, the oil embargo, where that was, you know, the Arab nations said, well, we're producing oil now. You know, you can't treat us like this. There was a lot of behind-the-scenes horse trading, but an arrangement was made between the United States and the Royal House of Saud that all oil that Saudi Arabia would produce would be done in US dollars in exchange for military protection of the Royal House of Saud. And so that was the Hail Mary. They pulled a rabbit out of the hat. The power base was moved from the United States to Saudi Arabia under the control of the United States. And so what that meant was the entire world had this world currency, the world reserve currency, the US dollar. But to do real economic actions, you needed oil. But to purchase oil, you needed US dollars. And so the entire world was then forced to engage in a fiat currency now, where it was openly fiat, it was only attached to basically the willpower of the United States of saying, we're the king. We're the king of the castle, so to speak. And it forced the entire world to put their entire future into a fiat currency they didn't control, where the United States could just print more money to balance its budget while they're engaging in things like the Cold War. And so from that point, the system has been trying to correct, as we've seen so many times in the past, like in Brazil 1994, Argentina 2001, and so on, Zimbabwe 2008. There gets a certain point when the system then overheats and then it's cooked and it says, this is ridiculous, let's just shut it all down. In Zimbabwe, for example, got hit with hyperinflation, and in 2008, they issued a $100 trillion note that was worth about 30 euros when they shut it down.
Yeah, I think somebody gave me one of those, actually.
I actually wanted to get one, but I never got around to it. Anyway, so what that means is the system's been expanding for about a century now, and the system has to expand at a certain rate to maintain the debt that's been created. The whole system is not the exchange of real money.
It's a Ponzi scheme.
Real monetary. And so the only way a Ponzi scheme can actually operate is if it can expand at a certain rate. And that's the problem. If that rate slows down even a little, that Ponzi scheme collapses. And that's the trouble we find ourselves in.
And we
And
need
so
energy for that expansion.
we need energy for the expansion, because energy is the real is what drives us. Even biological entities are run on energy of a kind. You cannot have action of any kind without energy. But you also need some form of system to use that energy to do useful things. Right? And that's a fundamental law. You see it in biology, you see it in ecology, you also see it in industry.
So how does the trade war, because a lot of people just think that this is all about Trump's decision, but it seems like there's something that transcends Trump here with the
Oh, yeah.
global decoupling and energy, and it's not solely something we can relegate to one man's ego. It is something much bigger, and it's to do with the fact that there is, on some level, some decoupling with the petrodollar and, well, oil and the dollar ultimately. Because, I mean, my high level view of things is that, okay, so that whole ship has run its course. And now the United States realizes that we can still have access to, a certain amount of oil into the future. So now it's time to kind of cut ourselves off from the rest of the world, and maybe in a not so time-released manner. There's more people who want to accelerate this process, and then there's some who want to do a soft landing. There seems to be this desire to take the dollar away from the global oil supply. Do they want to get rid of the dollar as the global reserve currency? Is that like a necessary step here in order to fully decouple?
I would say so, but it's been visible for a while. So I believe Trump is a symptom, not a cause. And if he didn't exist, someone would take his place. And we're seeing Trump-like figures popping up all over Europe now. Again, this is the idea of a layer and a time scale. The China system, which I've also been studying, here's another one of my fabulous books. The China plan has been in place for a very, very long time.
And what is that China plan?
So they want to the way they justify this is
They're preparing for
lasted
war.
yeah no they've been actively preparing for war for a very, very long time. Now what's the issue? Right, last century, what the British did to the Chinese over the Opium Wars, which was regime change, and they encouraged opium trade into China in exchange for making sure they get cheap tea and access to Chinese resources. It was ugly. It was nasty. The way the Chinese describe it for me is the Chinese culture was raped by the British in the late 1900s, in the late 1800s, sorry. And they call it the Century of Shame. And their motivation is loss of face. This must never happen again. So it's not revenge. The primary thing is loss of face to prevent it from happening again. China now must be made so strong they can never have a barbarian horde do this to us again, ever. As a distant second, they're talking revenge. Right? And that's what they're motivating. Now, the way they're going about this, the Western approach is the game of chess. We will take out our opponent by decapitating the king. Right. And so, military strikes and all the rest of it. And the entire Western world is part of that, not just the United States, and the British Empire perfected it. Right. So the Chinese mentality is the game of go. We will quietly take territory. And over time, we will quietly take territory and in the long range plan, all of a sudden you're outmaneuvered so comprehensively, there is no answer. The way they're going to do it, and this was just, I believe this plan started back in the 1970s, but we saw it first in a written form in 2003, was the first resource plan. The Chinese understood that it was not military power, but it was industrial power with the underlying layer of the value chain of the raw materials that feed that industrial power. So they put together a plan. And the plan was to become, long term, the world's global penultimate industrial superpower. And by 2049, they want absolute control of the whole system. That is, if you're going to buy a computer or a car or interact with anything that's technology-based or industrial-based, you will do business with the Chinese in some form on their terms. And the way they went about this was twofold. First, they said, well, we've got cheap labor. The globalist plan at the time was for money and control, thinking that they could actually keep control of the Chinese system. But sometime in the 80s, they lost control and they didn't notice. Was if you do business, you can transfer your industrial system out of the United States or Australia or wherever, Canada, take it to China where the costs are like a fraction. But the Chinese now own 51% of your business and the intellectual property of your business, but you're rich. You'll be rich. Oh, we don't care. We just as long as we're rich. And over time, they took all industrial capability all over the world. Everything moved into China. And over a 30, 40-year time frame, they took over everything. Now, because they have a different approach to stuff, they have a different business model. They weren't out there spending vast amounts of money with industrial ventures that don't actually do anything. They spent all their money in economic conquest, which had an economic return in a long-term context. They would do things like they will offer to go and build infrastructure in like a third world country. And this is the same sort of thing as it's actually the same model. Where is it? Ah, here we go. They're all in my bookcase right next to me. Confessions of an Economic Hitman is how the American system, the Chinese have a version of this, and they're still doing it. Right. So, they'll build like a port. And then the country's, oh, we can't pay our loan back. Oh, that's nice. We'll just take the port. Thanks, you default. That's how they got the Panama Canal. Right. So over time, they're going to, and in 2003, we saw the first resource plan. And I think there's if for your viewers, there's a paper released in 2015 called Made in China 2025. And that's when the first time someone in the West is saying, you know what, guys, we should look at this. Come on. Over here, look at this. But because our business model, your free market capitalism, if you've got the money, that's fine. An international free trade, that's fine. They have weaponized our own economic model against us where we are no longer necessary.
And
And
so
that's what's
their
happening.
whole strategy is just to become so insurmountably industrially powerful that at any time they could be in a position where they can now convert those industrial processes towards the ends of war mobilization. And
Yes, but they won't have to.
to an extent that we no longer have that capability. So my concern has always been, okay, when do those factories, if we do abandon them and they're no longer producing Nike shoes, then are they going to be converted into ones producing missiles and grenade launchers?
If they wanted to, they have to remember the Chinese system is vertically integrated. So in the plan that was actually we saw in 2003, the government, the People's Republic of China government, would give recommendations, as in do this, to the private sector, telling them where they wanted them to invest and put their money. And the private sector went out and did it. Right. And so when you're, let's say you're an entrepreneur and you want to start a business, and you're moving into an area where the Chinese are operating somewhere, which is pretty much everything industrial now. You will come up against the juggernaut of the vertically integrated Chinese system where everyone is collaborating with everyone else, where internally and domestically they're trying to do each other in, but when they are interacting with everyone outside of China, it's a united front where they're thinking in terms of conquest, but with the idea of a fifth generational warfare doctrine that is economic and information and social, but kinetic last. Right, and so it's a doctrine that they put together, and it's like We are so used to seeing things a certain way that we didn't even notice this was happening until fairly recently.
Well, it seems like it's very much in line with the art of war strategy to avoid a battle and win it at the same time, and how that's the most efficient way of doing so. Whereas, like you said, we view things in terms of conquest and colonization and imperialism, whereas they're engaged in this more expansion of the economic sphere of influence, which will ultimately subsume and then be able to have their will with the populations that are now under their economic auspices, so to speak.
Yeah, so it's a different kind of conquest, but all through history, human groups have done this. We've always done this in some form. It's nothing new. But imagine, if you will, the US Navy will send out a fleet far away from the United States to face an adversary, whoever that is, and they stop off on one of their allies on the way to refuel, and all of a sudden, they cannot pay for that refueling. Or the refueling stocks were not available for whatever reason. That fleet, all of a sudden, is no longer nearly as capable. So what they've done is used non-military means to make military means less effective, and they've done a whole lot of things to actually make the idea of a conflict almost irrelevant. Like in a fifth generational warfare context, the ideal is the target has no idea they're at war. They are manipulated into doing something that their adversaries want them to do, but they don't realize it. That's largely what's been happening to us, and it's only and now we get to another layer where the world was run by a global oligarch that was sort of like a mafia, and it was all over the world, but it was dominated by the West. They lost control of the Chinese in the 80s sometime, but they also lost control of the Russians. And the BRICS economies formed. The reason the BRICS economy consortium formed in the first place was to get out from under the Anglo petrodollar. Now, in t back to 2008, we had the GFC. It was now apparent that there was a problem. There was a blowout. They fixed it up by printing money. Okay, the 1973 petrodollar was now le coming to the end of its usefulness. They needed to find a replacement. My understanding is that replacement was the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but there was three of them: the TPP, TTIP, and the TISA. And it was an agreement between the large mega corporations of the world and the governments of the world, where they were going to integrate all economic value away from the BRICS economies and towards the United States. And that, if it worked, would have replaced the petrodollar to maintain the American empire. It was the next rabbit out of the hat. It failed. And when it did fail, that oligarch, which that you know you've got se several interests, let's call them interest groups, money. Who controls the money? Who controls the hedge funds? Where do it like These large hedge funds don't, they're in every country around the world, but they've got more money than entire nations. They're still like an invisible nation that's not democratically accountable. All right. So the United States was told, okay, your plan has failed. You've given away your industrial capability. So this is back in 2008, 2009. With the failure of the TPP, you've now got to re-establish your own industrial domestic capability. Now, we've seen for the last generations of American politicians, last time round, Trump had the Make America Great Again. What's he doing? He's bringing industry back to America. Biden, though, had Build Back Better. It's actually the same thing. And so both sides of politics were now quietly told, okay, the global empire and the structures under that empire are now falling apart to the point where they're not useful anymore. Fix it, do something else. And you're eroding. You're essentially in the position of the British at the end of World War II.
Right, because it seems as though like the changes Trump is making, when we're seeing trillions of dollars of volatility to the up and down side, it's somebody had made a joke yesterday about if he wanted to be erased. You know, he probably could, and so that he's doing this is somebody or some unseen consortium, as you say, of individuals is permitting him to make these drastic moves because it's something which is in the broader interest of America, which of course transcends the political situation.
I think so, but think on this. Wind the clock back, say 10 years, 2015 now. In 2015, the system that was the United States dollar was a fiat currency. It was on life support by printing an unprecedented amount of money on a daily basis. Every other nation state in the world also had a fiat currency, which means when the veil lifts, the whole system collapses. The geopolitical relationship between the United States and everyone else was on life support. When the Russians went into Syria and started bombing ISIS against the wishes of the United States, the American, the factions that were controlling the Americans, rather, were challenged for the first time in 70 or 80 years. And it says, all right, okay, we've gone from a quiet backroom disagreement to now an open fight. And when the American election in 2016 happened and Trump won, which surprised the hell out of everyone, then two factions within the American administration went to war with each other. They could only be described as a civil war at the executive level, openly. And since then, we've been seeing lawfare and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. One faction it was like the Night of the Long Knives, where the brown shirts were killed off by the SS in Nazi Germany. But that's been happening over the last 8-9 years, I suppose. And with the election of Trump in 2024, November 2024, one faction has decisively won now. And so now they're cleaning house, but they don't care about optics anymore. Now, consider this. Let's say we've got a timeline, say this long. We're going to go along this timeline. We know a crash is coming. Structurally, the system is so flawed that once this stuff's pointed out, since 1913, it's been apparent that there is a structural flaw to the system that holds us all together.
Right.
We know at some point there's going to be a crash. We know that crash cannot be avoided. We know that crash will involve every nation state around the world. And we also know that due to the system, nature of the system, it's not a small crash. It's going to be an intrinsic, systemic, fundamental crash where everything gets wiped out. We know that. We also know the underlying nature of our energy systems and our industry systems are about to metamorphose at the same time. Fossil fuels are going to be around for decades, but they're not going to be as the engine of growth, which our economics depends on. So we're seeing, for example, our economics is moving away from neoclassical economics into something else. And what that something else is, we're in the process of socially deciding. Right, so we know this window is going to happen. And every nation state in the world, in fact, you and I are jockeying for position as well. Every nation state's trying to work out, how do we actually get through this window? And on the other side of this crash, how do we actually make sure that our net position is as good as it could be? The entire prepper community is thinking the same way. What can I do to get my family into a position where we'll get through this okay? Or, hey, maybe even we're going to do well. It's exactly the same thinking, but at a greater scale. Right, so we've got this crash window. So we've got this period of time leading up to the crash where it's every damn thing, one damn thing after another. It's all going wrong. The death of 1,000 cuts, and it just seems to get worse. And the bullshit we are told on a daily basis is getting increasingly rabid, ridiculous. Come on, man, we're not going to believe that.
It's a theater of the absurd, and it gets...
Right.
The boundaries get stretched every day, it seems, in terms of what we accept as normal.
Right. So, but there comes a point where they're trying to keep, they don't, back to peak oil. The problem with peak oil, the date of peak oil was not the problem. It was the public perception of peak oil. Once people understand that that's what was going to happen, then they thought there were going to be mass panic and the government would lose control. Now that peak oil's evolved into something else, it's not peak oil anymore. It's when the system, it's understood that the system cannot function anymore in the same way, and the person on the ground now understands that. That's when, all right, it's all over. The strategic planners behind our society at all the different levels understand the situation's coming, and they understand that all existing institutions, for example, will be put under stress and strain, and certain systems won't work anymore. For example, money, insurance, banking, the law. The law's been cooked. No one trusts it anymore. The institution of governance, even our education system,
Everything's
science.
been diluted in the same way that the money supply has been diluted. All of those things that you just mentioned have also been diluted.
And they're demeaned, and they're all connected to each other. Right, so we get to a certain point where there's no fixing this. We've got to make a new system. And that new system is coming. And so when we hit the crash, whatever that new system will appear, and it's going to be radically different.
Okay.
Right? Every nation state understands this. China understands this, I believe, which is why their economy is crashing at the moment, but they don't care because if we're going into that window, oh, we don't need it anymore. The new system's coming, the gold-backed yuan, for example.
Okay, so you believe that there is a reversion to some sort of gold standard or.
So that's what the theory we would like to think. So remember the idea of the horse race. You've got multiple different horses. The idea of the classic understanding of a gold standard might be difficult because we've now become dependent on fast transactions that are digital. And so now we've got the idea of Europe, for example, is openly saying that no discussion. In October this year, they're going to roll out a European-backed global, a European-backed cryptocurrency, the CBDIC, or some version of that. Will society accept that? I don't know. With it comes a digital ID. Will society accept that? I don't know. And so this is the thing. Will the voting public go along with this, or so we ain't having this anymore?
Well, can I just say something about that? Because I find it interesting. If you look at Elon Musk as an example, and I often reference this, a few years ago, most of the people who support Elon Musk now would have railed against his technology as being potentially oppressive and something that could be used to essentially, coerce the population in ways. So Tesla vehicles used to be something which was like an iconic, like electric vehicles was something that was associated with the green movement. Now they're seen as symbols of rebellion by the right. Even though these systems are arguably, some of the most, there's a potential there for this to be misused in a technocratic sort of way, which is completely out of line, out of sync with what historically is, right-wing sort of values. But everything has kind of been supplanted. So the 2030 WEF agenda, I guess what I'm trying to say is that at one time people feared that, but now they've been almost not necessarily tricked, but in some ways been deceived into openly supporting the technology that's going to allow it and facilitate it in a way that, whether it's Twitter or Starlink, knowing where you are at any point and knowing where you are, on the planet, there's no escape now. Your cell phone, even if you go into the middle of the forest, they're going to be able to find you. Your car is constantly recording everything you do. All your transactions are traced, and the Bitcoin reserve and all of these things are now being associated with these things that at one point people were very worried about. People in that camp who were anti WEF are now tacitly and unknowingly embracing that.
This talks to the idea that we've been subject to an unconventional form of social conditioning, and we are programmed. Because the number of times that we like th there was a time when the left wing was very pro-peace, anti-war, pro-free speech, but now they've flipped. They're the reverse. For example, Donald Trump won in 2016, but he ran as a Republican. That's right wing. So to oppose Trump, they needed left wing groups to go out there and try and take him down. If Bernie Sanders won, for example, he was a left-wing outsider. And if he won, then the right, we would see right-wing groups going out. They're all programmed. There's a lot of theatre going on.
But it's
So,
all working towards the end of like a centralized
yes.
technological control system.
So remember the idea you've got factions. Two factions are going to war with each other. They both want essentially the same thing. Are they our friends? Not necessarily. So this is the idea of layers and horses. And while we are now seeing many conspiracy theories validated, openly validated, to the point where they're almost mainstream now, the solutions they're putting in place happen to be the transhuman agenda. You've got groups like the World Economic Forum, Agenda 2030, or before that, Agenda 21. And when you actually objectively look at what they're suggesting, it says, come on, man, you pull the other one who's got bells on. Things like Klaus Schwab, the leader of the World Economic Forum, to me, his job was to introduce certain ideas that they want to soften up the public to introduce. They'll be forced to be introduced in some form. He'll be blamed. He'll be taken out
Yes,
as
sacrificial
a, we've
lamb.
got him, we've defeated him, but now we've still got the
Yes.
system.
Yes.
And so he gets up and says stupid shit like, put the chip in the brain, you'll feel so much better about eating the bugs. And I
Yeah.
go, and wearing a James Bond villain costume. You're like,
Right. Yeah,
he,
it all seemed like it was planned that way.
it, it, it's when you look at it, it says, are we really that stupid? So we are being softened up and directed in a direction. What I think's happening though is human consciousness is evolving faster than their plans are evolving. So many people are waking up to this now that it's not working the way they plan. I think they've actually pulled the trigger too soon.
Well, if you look at the cyber cab is a great example because Klaus Schwab was notorious for his you'll own nothing and be happy. And here the champion of, freedom and liberation is saying, hey, this cyber cab will drive you around and only a few people are going to own them. And
There we
I see
go.
I don't own any homes. I sleep on a couch in my factory, right? And yeah, the transhumanist cosmists, kind of perspective. So it's incredible, but I do think there is definitely already pushback to it. People are kind of aware of it. Now, mind you, I'm far more cynical, which is why I'm in the third camp, perhaps, and I'm straddling the line between Arcadian and Prepper, and you'll make that hopefully clarify that typology that you created in a second, because I just feel as though, like you said, this crash has to happen. And what I'm concerned about is that the idealists who are what you would call Arcadians, and you can explain that in a second, maybe underestimate the criminality and the militaristic aspect and the violence that will ensue in this situation. And maybe that's where the prepper differentiates from the Arcadian. And this is one of the differences of opinion I have with Nate Higgins, whereas we agree on mostly everything, I'd say. Whereas I don't want to use the word naive because that's somewhat disrespectful,
I know
but
what you mean.
you're dealing with crime syndicates, and you have to be aware that there's a nasty component to all of this, and unfortunately, we can have these great ideas, but we also have to be ready for the darker side of this crash. Anyways, maybe just to kind of bring the conversation back down to earth, can you talk about the four groups that are emerging and manifesting at this period of time? You talk about the old school, the Vikings, the Preppers, and the Arcadians, and how exactly these groups are confronting this new reality.
So, my thing at the moment, like I was in the prepper community. I used to look at all the conspiracy theories, like everyone else, and everything. I used to be part of the Transition Town group back in 2010, and I actually took part in writing an energy descent action plan. The idea is how do we take a small town self-sufficient? Right, so that was the thinking. My thinking has now evolved since then, and I've now got a plan on the ground that involves the decentralization of the system now, where at a city scale, they control everything. What if the prepper community was handed disruptive technology that changed everything? That's the right. So I developed this model, this idea where society is going to split into four paradigms. And these four, each of those paradigms will dictate terms for what people actually do, what problem solving, what do we do with the building blocks we've given? Like you've dealt a hand of cards. What do we do with those cards? Four paradigms. Paradigm one, I call them the cornucopians. Yeah, but all the old school. These are the people who will think the way we think now. So new technology can come online, but the way we would use it is the way we use it now. And we will defend to the bitter end how things are done now. They don't want to hear about any of these challenges. No, that's fake news. Leave me alone.
Right.
You're thinking negative.
There's no such thing as peak oil.
Don't be a negative Nancy. Someone will think of something.
Right.
Someone will save us. Not Musk. No, not him. But someone will save. Right. And so, yes, they're thinking like it's still 1950 in here. And what I'm finding with each of these groups, it's very, very hard to talk to other groups. But the old school in particular are very, very aggressive in pushing, we are right, you are wrong. To the point where if you try and discuss any ideas with them, they will, how often have you tried to describe with someone a challenging idea and they just won't accept it, they won't have it, and the conversation deteriorates into a shouting match. We've all had that.
And it's getting worse because of that imprudent anonymity that happens on the internet where, people don't have to be accountable.
Oh, the keyboard warriors. I get a lot of those. So, all right. So the second group is a group I call the Vikings, or the pirates is the other way to put it. They're the people who, things are tough. Oh, well, let's go and take stuff. So instead of actually getting out there and trying to make something, they'll try and exploit the situation for self-gain. In Australia, for example, we were thinking that the bikie gangs are the most likely candidate. Where they'll go and take stuff. But I pointed out the following. If the future is people band together into communities, and that community is the resilience, the Vikings will go out and take stuff, and the occasional raid will convince people that this is what they have to do. The world's changed.
Is this the Trump camp right now?
No.
Because I would have thought like we're going to take the Gaza Strip and we're going to take, Greenland and we're going to.
So what I see another layer there at a political level, and what we're seeing is theatre, right? What we're seeing theatre, and there is a dust up between the two factions that are battling for control, and I think legal lawfare has been engaged in several decades ago. What exa For example, imagine if, say, Canada, Mexico, Australia, New Zealand, all of those countries, when they incorporated, those corporations are legally owned by the United States, right? And the United States, when it incorporated, it's legally owned by someone in London. We think the world has worked a certain way, but the actual power structures have been completely different in the background, and those power structures are being destroyed at the moment. And so what we are then doing is presented with a, we're now going to take Greenland. It says, what? Why? I don't get it. That doesn't make sense. Canada is now part of the United States. What? Ah, come on, get off. No. But what I think that does is brings a certain issue to the surface where it can be discussed and fought out in a parallel arena. It's not about Canada joining the United States. It's about how these entities have interacted with each other. And so what we are shown and what we are told is different to reality and what will happen. I'd be very surprised, for example, if it does come to pass that Canada and Mexico join the United States. Remember the old North American Union idea? That was, they were talking about the Amero culture, coin and everything.
Amero,
Apparently at the time, legal documents were signed and alliances were signed where the countries at some level politically merged. And that was a conspiracy theory. But if that was true, what we're seeing now play out is that's now being dredged to the surface and that's going to be destroyed. I can't see Canada going along with that. I can't see Mexico going along with that.
So what's the main difference then between the old school cornucopians and the Vikings then? Like, give me an example of like a Viking, how they would approach this coming crash.
Right. So the old school says, oh, we're going through, you know, an economic downturn, tighten your belt. You know, we've been through this before. You know, things will just turn around eventually. But we're just going to see, you know, a bit of poverty for a while and there'll be an economic correction. Yeah, we've been through this before.
Just a cycle.
It's a cycle, you know, and don't be so dramatic. Whereas the Viking mentality will go,
there's a problem.
Breaking. Everything's breaking. The law is no longer the law anymore. So if we were to get together, say, get a few chaps together and get our guns together and go and take stuff, no one could stop us. Huzzah! And so the idea of gaining wealth and getting what you need, instead of going out and earning it or creating it yourself, you're going to go and take it from someone else. And we're going to see that at all levels.
So is that not then like the Russia-Ukraine situation, the China-Taiwan situation, the Israel Gaza situation?
It could be seen as a version of that. I think the Russia-Ukraine, in fact, all of those situations are a geopolitical chess match move between the big factions trying to get stuff. Like Ukraine, for me, is all about which financial system's allowed to survive.
Yep.
The Anglo-Petrodollar or the BRICS.
I agree 100%. Dollar. Yeah.
Yeah. And the poor people in Ukraine have been hung out to dry. Anyway, so this is, for example, Argentina, 2001, there were the roving gangs that used to go around and take stuff, and there was no government to stop them anymore. At the same time, I suppose you could see a version of the American government saying we want Greenland, and everyone's going, huh, what? Or we want the Panama Canal. We're going to take the Panama Canal. Really? Is that legal? Is that lawful? Is that ethical? No, shut up. We want the Panama Canal. That's Viking.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So the prepper community, that's the third group, they're groups of people who understand that the normal ways of doing things have broken down. And they've got to take care of things for themselves. And we'll see that again at all levels. Usually, for example, a town will say, well, okay, available food's not coming to the supermarket anymore the way we think. Perhaps we should get together and start growing our own veggies. And so this is the Maslow hierarchy of needs. You know, it'll be security, it'll be food, it'll be
shelter,
clean water, it'll be sanitation, energy, it'll be just consumables to keep our equipment going, and so on. We will now take care of business ourselves. And because our system is now global and very, very complex, we're now talking about a world that'll be much, much simpler and have a very different form. And it'll be all about, well, we know it's not perfect, but we are going to take care of things ourselves. It'll be decentralized. So instead of, say, like the United States is one big gigantic nation, it'll break up into lots of little small groups that maybe they'll trade and everyone's going to do things differently. But it'll be, you know, we'll take care of our own food production. We will, take care of our own school education if we can. Education is something that we've actually gotten very used to having, for example. But if you were to go back, say, 4 or 5 centuries and, like, say in Europe, and then say, right, well, our young, instead of hitting the farms at the age of 4 or 5 and becoming farm laborers, we're going to send them to school for 12 years with another 10 years on top of that, which is, you know, I was at school for 22 years. Society wasn't able to do that without high-density energy and the technology that came with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we lose those systems, does that mean we lose the capability of things like education at the rate that we have?
So the preppers are front running the simplification, as Higgins calls it. They're beginning.
So as it's all coming apart, what do? The prepper community could represent the part of society that will ensure a civilized society survives.
Mm-hmm.
Not
necessarily evolve it technologically in along the same trajectory that it's been purported to be evolving along.
No, but it's from a social point of view, it's we will ensure our own resilience now We will ensure our own human rights. We will ensure our own necessities. We will not be dictated terms by a centralized government or a foreign government or whatever that no longer has our best interests at heart.
Looking at education, for example, okay, homeschooling is one thing, but now we have AI, which could potentially be a way better teacher than a human ever could for a child, because it could give them a customized curriculum, which was perfectly catered to, you know, their stage of development in whatever subject matter. And it's almost as though, like, that hyper-centralization has almost spawned a new potential for decentralization in a way, in that it was the centralization that got us to the point and the universality of, you know, tech that enabled us to create and train these algorithms on these computer systems, which were cost-effective thanks to, you know, global supply chains. And now we've reached a point where that's accessible to even the prepper. So you have this hybrid, you know, cyber prepper of sorts who can leverage technology to kind of recreate the specialized systems that obviously a traditional prepping community couldn't facilitate because there wasn't enough energy per se. The energy has already kind of been invested, you know, previously in other parts of the system, and now the prepper can deploy those gains that humanity has made, you know, individually in these situations, whilst perhaps not advancing the broader community and still remaining in these smaller fiefdoms, you know, throughout the wasteland, whereas the Arcadians are still thinking more big picture and still trying to move this technological advancement forward. Is that a safe assessment?
So the preppers are looking at the short-term realities of life.
Right.
Right. So the preppers are, and as for AI, who controls that AI and what do they want? Mm-hmm. And the problem with AI is, I don't know if you've, when I was a kid, I used to drive a car and we had what was called a Refidex, a book full of maps. And that's how I navigated. But now I'm dependent on Google Maps.
Yeah.
When I'm in a new town. Part of my brain has been shut down. I'm now dependent on a machine to tell me what to do. The problem with AI is the human species may become more capable, but less capable within themselves, like the movie WALL-E.
Yep.
You know,
the smarter AI gets, the dumber people get.
So I actually, when I talk to my students and I talk to the people around me, they said, what do we do with AI? I said, you cannot ignore AI. So AI is not the problem. It's the people who would use AI and weaponize it against us while we still don't understand what it is. That's the problem. You shouldn't use AI, for example, to write a report. Because, you know, the report, you've got no idea, you know, garbage in, garbage out, can you trust it? You've also got AI systems detecting other AI systems. So if someone looks at your report and says, and they've got a more advanced AI, say a year or two down the track, says you wrote that with AI, suddenly you're busted. You've got a problem. But what you can do, if you've got to learn to use AI so you're not scared of it. So what I do is I use AI as a planning tool. Tell me the issues. Tell me the moving parts. Tell me the questions to ask. And then I put that up against what I normally do. Then I shut the AI down and I take that list and I develop what I need to develop, but it's me that does it and it means that writes it. And what that means is I'm slower than a pure AI, but it's me and no one can take it off me.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So when we get to the, that's just a personal approach. And I don't know if that's going to stay the same. I might evolve into something else. We'll see. But that's where I'm at the moment. Now, the Arcadians, I see them as a subsection of the prepper group. The prepper group deals with reality front and center, as in we need food, we need to work damn hard over the next 3 or 4 months planting crops and getting stuff ready, all hands on deck, no exceptions, everyone works. Right, but once you're established, now what? Because the prepper community will break back to, say, an 1880s level of society complexity with the occasional 1930s level of technology that they can reproduce themselves, like you wind an electric motor, for example, but you won't make a microchip. And for a while, you'll have rare examples of, say, 2020s level technology like a computer. But computers don't last very long. Now, 5, 10 years, they start needing replacing. And so if the supply chain breaks down, or if the supply chain becomes very geopolitically controlled and only certain people are allowed to have certain things, and the dystopian world that you were talking about, for example, the internet and AI for that matter, is now becoming a matter of the police state surveillance that's actually sort of coming out, and terms are being dictated about who gets access to what. That's behind the Internet of Things that's been rolled out in Europe from our mate, Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum, the Fourth Industrial Revolution. I don't believe it will work because the complexities involved, but it will, if they try and force it, you'll have like regions where some things work and regions where nothing works. And if you happen to be in one of those regions, life's not going to be very nice because nothing works. And anyway,
It'll
so
be
the
a Hunger Games
Arcadians,
scenario.
And how does a small number of key people keep a large number of people in place to accept crushing food shortages, massive poverty, and everything when it becomes apparent that those same people knew this was happening decades ahead of time and did nothing? And that is my belief is why that whole police state surveillance stuff is needed in the first place. It's not there to help us, it's there to contain us so the people involved can maintain power. They've already got all the money, it's power. They wish to maintain power.
And their advantage.
And advantage, and then within that group, you've got the Game of Thrones mentality about which of those groups maintains overall power. Who's in control? And it's a big club, and you're not in it. Neither am I.
So the Arcadians are the people who've okay, they acknowledge that there's a problem. They're prepared for the problem or preparing, like Nate Higgins, who I referenced many times throughout this talk, has a farm and he's got chickens and now he's trying to think about solutions. So the Arcadians are more solution focused.
Well, the preppers are also solution based as well, but they're in the here and now, based on what we have now. The Arcadian mentality, the Arcadian paradigm, is the understanding that society is about to metamorphose into something else. But it took a, you don't have a complex system and you build it whole cloth. You've got to start with a simple system and develop it over time. Right? So you've got to develop new technologies and new ways of doing things. And then over time, you've got to develop it. And so the Arcadians are thinking in terms of what might our society become where if we use the best science had to offer us now, but we optimize it to the quality of life of the people in that society in context of the limitations we are now subject to. We are operating like there's no limits, but some limitations are about to be applied. How do we maintain, for example, education of both genders everywhere in a ubiquitous fashion where our young can go to school for 20 years before joining society? So that how do we maintain, for example, the ability to generate electricity and use it the way we're doing it at the moment? How do we maintain the ability to make a computer? And how do we take a step forward? Does humanity take a step backwards? Do we go into a dark age? Or do we use this as a transformative moment and human society at large goes through a Phoenix maneuver? But this is not a simple ask. It's not the sort of thing that can happen next week. The people who take this on will have to understand that they will dedicate their lives to something that they may never see. It will take decades. I remember Mike Ruppert saying he thought a 60-year transition from one system to the next is going to be a really hard, hard transition. I was thinking maybe a century, where we will transform and a parallel system will develop, and over time, as the existing system decays and falls apart, the new system will grow and replace. And the Arcadians are thinking long term in a positive solution, where on the other side of this, humanity has a future worth having. Whereas the
It's,
prepper could think,
yeah, no, I was just going to say it's very difficult in our hyper individualistic society to have that legacy style thinking. And in order to do that, there really almost has to be not necessarily a spiritual element, but there has to be something beyond just the material understanding of this. You know, like there has to be, like, even the Chinese, because of their political system, they can look at these things on a decadal scale and they can plan more long term, whereas we're every 4 years we're seeing a change in government, and so it's very difficult to do that long term sort of planning. How can we foster this mentality that's going to be required to transition from this world of scarcity and to one in which we have to adapt and create a new paradigm?
So I think we're both we humans are both the solution and the problem. It comes down to how we see things and what we do with how we see things. And at the moment, we are convinced to fight amongst ourselves on things that don't matter. We are convinced to spend our time and energy on things, and we're convinced to reject solutions. Like Europe at the moment is going through a phase where it can't agree on the color of an orange, and historians might say Europe had the fate of they were going to freeze to death in the dark because they couldn't fill in the paperwork. I've seen them choose to fail again and again and again, and it's very demoralizing. So what I'm trying to say here is first, we as a human, as a species, both individually but also in groups, have got to evolve into something else. For example, when the Industrial Revolution, society evolved in how we thought. It was very painful at the time. Actually, here's another way to put it. Around, say, the 16th century, what we call science manifested for the first time and merged with philosophy and changed the world. Paradigm shifted. A few centuries later, the Industrial Revolution kicks off in its first form. What we call engineering manifests for the first time, merges with money and changes the world. This is the start of the neoclassical economic model. That's now breaking down. So now
That's the third industrial revolution.
the first industrial revolutions when that basically coal came along and we started using steam tech. The second one is when internal combustion engines were developed and the electric motor was developed. The third one was but nuclear. Nuclear coupled with nuclear power was developed at the same time as the microchip and the transistor and that kind of technology. And the fourth industrial revolution is supposed to be information based, which I think I
AI.
think that 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 that, that yeah, and all that. But the paradigm of all four industrial revolutions is the same paradigm. How can we use technology in to the thing of growth, economic growth, and wealth creation? But that wealth creation is to push everything up the food chain. We make a small number of people rich, and we hope it just gets better for everyone. And life at the moment is very different to what it was several centuries ago. There's both good things and bad things, though. But I think we're going to see a macro scale shift to something else. And it's going to be neoclassical economics is going to break down to some sort of biophysical, ecological economics that involves physical reality is going to impose itself. And if I was to use a phrase to describe what's coming, situation awareness manifests and merges with the ability to understand what's real and what's not. And the world changes. So much at the moment is horseshit. So much, it's just not real.
Well, it goes back to the gold standard and how, you know, these derivatives of derivatives of derivative, everything is a copy of a copy of a copy. And it's so the survival instinct will be your ability to discern what is real from what is not. And a big part of that is going to be to understand that in order to survive what's coming, you need to be focused on those real things that are going to sustain life. And most people aren't there yet mentally. Like most people don't consider prepping, you know, that their version of prepping is going and buying insurance, which is great. It's good to have insurance. But they're so out of touch with what sustains life, with those Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Everything is provided to them. so they don't have to create these things themselves. And if we do regress even temporarily to a first or second, industrial revolution of sorts, these people will be hopelessly dependent on the vestiges of what remains of this civilization if they don't have those self-sustaining systems in place.
So that my idea of what prepping is needed has actually evolved over the last 20 years, and it's very interesting. Let's come back to that, because what I believe the Arcadians will work with is a series of technologies that change everything. Now, the social contract of how we do things is dictated by the technology we have available and the energy to run that technology. Now, if raw materials to supply our technology are getting harder and harder to get hold of, but the energy that we use is about to go from fossil fuels to something else, then that system will change and that technology will dictate terms. Plan A was fossil fuels. Plan B was supposed to be the green transition, wind power, solar panels, what have you. That looks like it's facing several bottlenecks, so it's not going to go forward the way it is. A third alternative has to be found. And in terms of energy, I'm looking at three systems. Three, not just one, three. The first one is thorium molten salt nuclear power in a modular form. That's actually up and running now. The Chinese are doing it. I went to a factory in Copenhagen in Europe that is actually making these things. A shipping container size. Yeah, imagine you're in a prepper community, right? You've got a community, I don't know, say 1,000 people, and you've got a shipping container size nuclear reactor that's pumping out 100 megawatts of thermal power at 560 degrees Celsius, which, if you have a turbine next to it, that gives you about 40 megawatts of electricity. That's industrial scale power on a very small footprint, where most of what goes into this is actually steel, alloys of steel and nickel. Right? It's
So
a much, much smaller.
you believe that that's scalable. There's enough thorium.
Oh, there's plenty of thorium. So I actually went through there's several thousand years of thorium if we were to keep energy consumption at the same time we were to do it. Is it scalable? Is more a case of can we manufacture enough of these things and get them out fast enough? The rate determining step is our governments allowing a license.
And why wouldn't they?
So you've got the incumbent industries of nuclear that don't want to see this happen. Thorium nuclear power was shown by the Oak Ridge Nuclear Laboratory in 1972, again that date, to work. They had like a decades of research, and they basically, this works. We want permission to build a full-scale reactor now. Now, we didn't have an energy crisis at the time. We didn't have an environmental crisis or anything like that. We didn't have resource constraints. What we had was the Cold War, and the military was calling the shots. And what they wanted was a civilian uranium nuclear power plant fleet to disguise the production of nuclear weapons. If we go thorium, that entire uranium system will be shut down as unnecessary, and the production of nuclear weapons would be exposed.
So there's no way to weaponize thorium for them. So there's no
You
incentive for the
can if you
NIC.
really, really, really want to, but it's not sensible to do so if you've got uranium. You've got to take thorium, put it in a reactor, bombard it with a neutron source to convert it to uranium. And then it gets consumed with the fuel, and it's an isotope that's not very efficient. It's actually just much more efficient just to go up and dig uranium and use that instead.
I mean, if they really thought it was a matter of national security, though, couldn't they continue to enrich uranium alongside the thorium production? Like, is there
Oh,
not
they
a.
could, but it would become very obvious. It would become very obvious to an outside group that's what's happening.
But
It
if
becomes
we're
a
entering
target.
into a. It appears as though we're entering into a new age of nuclear proliferation once again, where people are going to be openly doing this. Sorry to bring some realism to the conversation, but that's it, the trajectory we're on, right? Is to potentially renuclearize our military arsenals.
They're going to
So,
try, but there are practical bottlenecks in doing so.
anyways, thorium is a possible solution, or at least not in the Jevons paradox sense that we're just going to end up using more and more energy, anyways. But at least it's a temporary solution to dealing with the oil scarcity and the other renewable energy
So it's a
limitations.
solution. It's a solution. Because it's not actually out there and being used, there are probably a few things we're going to have to learn how to use. The thinking is it's militarily uninteresting because it's simply not efficient to use. You just go after uranium instead. The problem will be manufacturing some of the components in it. And so is scale up may not as go as easy as it could. But if we have a small number of reactors, that energy concentrator thing will change what is possible for a small number of communities. And that small number of communities could form a kernel that will actually be able to keep things going. Right. So that technology, I'm about to release a report where I actually map the state of Hawaii. If the state of Hawaii was to actually transfer to this, they would need 52 such 40-foot shipping container units across the islands. And that would do all their energy needs, including transport.
And is there any risks like there are with nuclear fuel in terms of spent
So
fuel and things of that nature?
conventional uranium fuel, now, all industry has risks, but this is a different profile. This is a liquid. The difference is liquid fuel. The key is liquid fuel to versus conventional solid fuel. Solid fuel, if you've got pellets of uranium, they enrich it to about 4% uranium-235. That's the isotope they need for the reaction. They put it in the reactor, the fuel's consumed, but when they take it out, 96% is still uranium-238. And it's not useful to them. And so when they're storing waste, it's highly radioactive uranium. Right, and it's very difficult to handle and everything. And so you've got a massive footprint. These liquid fuel systems start out as a salt, like thorium with fluoride or chloride salt. And we convert the thorium to uranium by bombarding it with neutrons. And then the uranium heats up the salt and it turns into a liquid. And the liquid goes around the reactor in a heat exchange unit. It's already liquid, so it can't melt down. If the reactor gets too hot, what's a process called Doppler broadening means there's a cascade of that reaction and it overruns itself and shuts down. You've also got freeze plugs where if there's a problem and it gets too hot, the fuel can drain out of the reactor itself into tanks where it can be managed separately. The fuel that you put in, 96% gets consumed, so only 3% has to be stored as waste. Waste problems. But you store it for 300 years, not 10,000 or 100,000 or whatever the standard is. So it's a much, much smaller footprint. The complexity of running this thing is equivalent to running a nuclear isotope lab in a hospital.
And where is thorium produced? Like, which countries are the main producers?
No one cares about thorium at the moment. There is no market for it. Any rare earth mine will have what's called radioactive elements of uranium and thorium in it, and they're a penalty element they want to get rid of. The existing uranium industry has stockpiles of thorium as waste that they're just drawing because they just need to do something with it. Thorium is four times more abundant than uranium in the crust, but because we don't want it as such, we're not exploring for it. Any rare earth mine will have thorium as a waste product.
So, like, which countries would be leaders in terms of stockpiles of
Well,
that?
France has a nuclear stockpile of thorium because they've been processing nuclear waste for a long time. China has just found a massive thorium deposit, if you can believe their reports. The United States has masses of monazite deposits that they don't know what to do with, so they just buried it again. India has a beach that's very, very rich in thorium. So thorium's actually all over the world. But you need so little of it, I don't think it becomes a matter of like if everyone's got it and if everyone can use it, then it doesn't have to be something that's subject to geopolitical constraints anymore.
Well, you would think with the Chinese, who are not maybe slightly less beholden to various industrial complexes, would be able to see the value in leveraging something like this,
They're
especially
doing
seeing
it.
as,
They're doing it now.
okay, they are doing it.
So in 2022, they had a 2 megawatt system in the Gobi Desert as a trial to selling power commercially, and they don't need water to cool it, so it's functioning just fine in the desert. They've got four or five other larger operations. The Chinese are taking the approach, because their system is so large and they've got so much money, that they will put all technologies on the ground and say, we will give you each several hundred million US dollars. Go, show us what you can do. And so they're backing wind and solar, they're backing hydro, they're backing conventional nuclear, but they're also inventing all the unconventional nuclear systems. And they're seeing how it goes.
And what are the other two? You said there were three
There were
sources?
three. Okay, so these are unconventional technologies that are more theoretical and they're not considered acceptable. But when you go down the rabbit hole, there's enough papers in the literature to show that they are real. And so this is the sort of thing that if I was to say it in a meeting professionally, people would laugh at me and throw me out of the building. Okay. Technology number two, zero point energy, also quantum fluctuation. Nikola Tesla made a number of ideas famous, and one of them was that he believed we were sitting in a sea of energy. And Casimir, a scientist called Casimir in the 50s, predicted that at a subatomic level, there is an energy field. And in 1984, they proved that it existed. So this is at a subatomic level. We are sitting in a sea of energy that is vast. And says the idea that we could harvest energy at a subatomic level requires a certain level of technology development to do it. Conventional thinking is the zero point field does exist, but it's too weak to be useful. What it comes down to is two aluminium plates very close together, and as you pull them apart, you are harvesting electricity from the quantum flux. The smaller the plates are and the closer they are together, the more effective it is. And in 1984, they were able to prove it very weakly. But now we've got things like 3D printing and nanotechnology. So now very, very, very small is now possible. I do believe technology like this is possible, but it requires research. We've got to go down the rabbit hole and look at stuff. Every time someone's come up with this idea, they've disappeared into the military and never to be seen again. Look, I'm a physicist. My primary degree is physics and geology, right? And one of my physics lecturers said, well, we noticed all their textbooks were from the 1960s, and nothing seemed to have changed since then. And this is what, in the 80s. And so what? So nothing's happened for the last 20 years. And so anyone who's any good who comes up with anything new gets a tap on the shoulder and gets absorbed into the military, and we never see them again. And there was one lecturer, a Dr. Waterworth. He was pulled into the American system to work on the Star Wars project, shooting down lasers in orbit. And his thing was, how can you get a megawatt laser class performance out of a kilowatt laser class unit? If you get like a small unit, get it up into orbit, and it's much more powerful. And he used mirrors to break the laser up, but then get the lasers to interfere constructively on the target, thus having a much greater impact. Anyway, when he tried to leave, the American military basically tried to intimidate him, and he lost everything. But he had to come back for his family. I think his father was not far off passing or something. He needed to come back. He lost everything, and to get even, he put certain things that were on the Star Wars project on the exam. In that university going forward. So for a couple of years, the Star Wars project was actually on the exam.
Yes.
Dr. Waterworth sends his regards, you bastards. So
So because he's dealing with what they would consider national security risk information, they tend to disappear anyone who reaches these new frontiers of innovation.
don't die. They don't die. What happens is they get so, oh, come with us, we're going to give you a job. By the way, you are now classified. Please don't tell anyone what you're doing. And they do it. And so the military then develops in a parallel track to the point now, you've got like a group called the Breakaway Civilization, that that's been doing military research for so long now that they are many, many hundreds of years ahead of the civilian sector.
And then when you add artificial intelligence on top of that, What are your thoughts on that? And maybe, well, before I ask you about that, let's just talk about the third one, and then we'll.
The third technology is called electrogravitics. The US State Department released a picture saying what they call UFOs that are now relabeled UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomena, are real. So the White House basically came out and said, look, they're real. We don't know what they are. They're not ours. And they said some can be explained away, but not all. And they made a very public release. And there was a series of photographs they released. I don't care who or what is flying these things. What I want to know is what's the technology behind it and what's its power source. And the only thing that it makes sense. So you've got a device that can move very fast without any control surfaces or any visible propulsion system that is able to move in a very erratic fashion very, very quickly. Like they're not performing like a jet in the air, which has to adhere to fluid dynamics. Like a fighter jet, if it looks like a fighter jet, it has to fly like a fighter jet and it has to go to a certain rules. If it looks like a helicopter, it's got to fly like a helicopter according to certain rules of aerodynamics around the blades. These units, whatever they are able to operate in ways that are not using those same physics. The only thing that actually fits that profile is the work of Thomas Brown, Townsend Brown. Anyway, so back in the 1920s, someone came up with the idea of electrogravitics, and he was written off as a quack. And there was a lot of one of the things you notice in if you go back to the physics gazettes in, say, the 40s and 50s, is in the 40s, it was believed that someone the sequence was what they called anti-gravity, which is electrogravitics, where you can actually turn off the force of gravity and things move in a different way, was possible. About a decade later, in the same magazines, they're saying it was inevitable that someone was going to work it out. It was just a question of who. Then it all went quiet, and then a whole series of articles came out. Anyone who thinks electrogravitics is real is a crank and a quack and should be shunned by society. And it says, okay, that's code for the military thought, hey, this is a good idea. We don't want the civilian population to have it. And so they were smeared. The reason I take it seriously now, is what we saw that the White House has actually put out, whether they are UFOs, which is what they're implying, or they're actually just high tech and a different kind of technology that is not part of our normal infrastructure. And the technology is real, or at least all the solutions are not on the table from our point of view. There are things more possible. That requires a lot of research and development, but at the moment, you can't say such things out loud without destroying your career.
Well, there's that old saying, advanced, true advanced technology will be indistinguishable from magic, from a
So,
previous generation. So, like, I mean, if you were to go and, show a phone to somebody in the medieval era, they would think that you were some sort of possessed demon. I mean, in the same way that we can't conceptualize a control over gravity, I'm presuming that the leap is not that much further.
So to say such things out loud, people are going, oh, you're not wrapped too tight. Yeah, come on, mate. But hang on a sec. Our existing fossil fuel systems are about to become unreliable. Whether we really are on peak oil or it's a couple of years away, it actually doesn't matter. It's around now. Our economic system is going sideways as well. We need to socially evolve. We need to source our raw materials differently. If we can have a replacement energy system that can provide concentrated forms of energy in any weather on a small footprint, then we are actually back in business. And those three technologies have the capacity to do that. Thorium molten salt is operational now. I've been to a factory that's making them. I haven't seen an operating unit, but the Chinese are doing it. I believe the Americans are doing it through the Department of Homeland Security. Rolls-Royce are doing it in the UK. There's about 15 operators around the world that are working on this. The other two are considered are considered not acceptable by the establishment, but there's enough in the literature to show that they are theoretically possible. And I do think we're going to see a renaissance in the next couple of years around that, because conventional systems are failing. And I actually believe this is why we're actually seeing disclosure. The military's been sitting on this tech for a while, but now they've got to get it to the civilian population soon. Otherwise, we're in real trouble.
Yeah, I have a bit more of a cynical view on that. I almost feel as though it's a distraction of sorts, but
Agreed, agreed.
there might be something to it. I'm sure there is. There's so much that we don't know to believe that what we know now is in any way close to the high point of what we will know is just foolish.
So it
So.
is absolutely agreed that it's a distraction. It is no coincidence that this has been waved in front of our noses now. Look away, look over here, don't look at that, look at this over here. Of course. We're run by monkeys. It's a clown. Was it, instead of making a sleek engine of prosperity, we made a clown car, like ridiculous trade swaps. We're run by evil clowns. So it absolutely is a distraction. What I'm saying is options two and three are not proof. I'm open-minded to its possibility. I've seen enough, though, for option one to think that that's a real viable thing, to the point where I'm writing reports about it.
Well, that's it's good to know that there is possible solutions here, and there are new energy sources that are untapped. And I guess the whole conversation will come down to who gets to control said energy sources. But what is your take on AI and how this factors in? Because often we hear, well, AI is going to create something new that is going to and it is going to accelerate this move towards these more advanced technologies, and the things that are intellectual shortcomings will be made up for by this technology. How do you think it factors into the global multipolar world that's emerging?
I see AI as a more advanced version of Google search. Right. So our ability to get information and organize it will now evolve and become something else. I don't believe AI can magic up new physical resources. I don't think AI can replace human interactions on all levels. So AI will make some things easier, some things easier, but it will not be the magic bullet that solves all their problems. What it will do is consume a lot of energy and resources. And then that comes down to who controls those data banks? Who controls those data centers?
Data is truly the new oil, and I'm not sure if have you interacted at all with the ChatGPT voice, not the text-based system, but the one you actually talk to.
I have, and it scared the shit out of me because I didn't know it was an AI. I thought I was talking to a person. And then it turns out, oh, you're an AI. Oh, because it had a picture of a person, and that person was talking. It was like a picture like I see you now. And it was a picture like that, but the whole thing appeared to be AI. It wasn't real.
So,
And I
I
didn't
mean,
know.
move that forward a couple years, and the rate that, nobody knew about ChatGPT 2 years ago, just a little over 2 years ago. And now we're already to the point where it's creating movies. It is able to hold a conversation. We've passed the uncanny valley in many respects, and it appears as though we're on the cusp of a major shift, a major transformation that is going to map on or is going to require demand what you're talking about with this new energy, if we can get through this great filter of potential conflict. Now, maybe just to conclude, what is your best and worst case scenarios for the current state of geopolitical tensions around the world? Because, of course, that is really the elephant in the room here. We're talking about building out thorium plants and creating this Arcadian, dare I say, utopia. Well, how do we overcome the potential tensions that await, and what is your best and worst case scenario for how it all plays out in the China theater, the Middle East, Ukraine? And maybe, I know that's a lot, but if we can keep it relatively brief.
Good luck with that. Right, so first of all, the reason AI is so seductive to us is we live in a virtual world. Our economics since 1913 have been the idea that we can invent stuff. We can just magic up stuff and it's real. We can invent money. In 1971, we went to a fiat currency so we can just print money and it doesn't matter. Our neoclassical economic model is the idea that something's value is not what it took to make something, but its perceived value. If I can convince something it's worth many times more than it is, and they give me the money, then that's real. So we live in a world that's virtual. Now we're in a world at the moment where thoughts and feelings matter more than facts. And we've got the idea of fake news. And life now happens through the internet. And our young, for example, my daughter she's obsessed with her phone. And life for her runs through her mobile phone. Right. So AI, when it says, oh, AI can change everything, it changes everything in a virtual world. But that virtual world is not the real world. And that virtual world is dependent on things like energy and raw materials and things to be organized. That virtual world is also becoming really, really controlled in a police state context. So I sort of see that whole thing is going to get to a point where it's going to unravel, or people at large will realize that if we keep going down this direction, that they're being trapped, but there's an entire other world out there. And if we return to the physical world and become less dependent on internet-based services, then what we call AI becomes limited in what it can actually do for us if we need raw materials. So that's the snapshot of what I think about that. We must conquer it so technology serves us. We don't serve technology. We must evolve. We must overcome our fear of this and become stronger than it.
Okay.
Right. So I believe the world has been heading towards a period of transformation for some time. It's been understood that the globalist free trade. There were two paths. One was a global system, a global government one government that oversees everything, and you've got like some sort of electronic police state system that controls everyone and everything. With the appearance of Trump, that system has fractured, and now a parallel plan is taking its place. We are seeing a lot of those things unraveling. Meanwhile, the idea of a cryptocurrency, and Musk's Neuralink idea, for example, a new society is taking its place that will probably do the same things, but in ways we don't understand. All the conventional ways of seeing things are breaking down, and new ones are taking that the people at large think that they are getting past it, but actually they're not. And the question is, will humans, the human species, evolve past that too? Because we're evolving very quickly. It's entirely possible that their plan won't work by virtue of podcasts like you, mate.
Yeah,
Anyway,
maybe.
well, information. The public has gotten educated, and at a level we are now ha handling certain ideas and communicating them to each other. We are not as susceptible to be doing toing, to be told what to do, and it became such a problem they invented fake news
Right.
to the point where
But
we don't
it's a
care.
double-edged sword too, right? Because with the emergence of AI, there's the potential for these algorithms to be manipulated and for people's, while this information is so empowering, it can also be misinformation at the same time and be used against us.
So the human species then evolves to the point where it can see information and decide what's real and what's not in a discerning point of view, and then decide whether to be in a state of fear or not, where we collaborate with the person next to us, but it's going to be in a decentralized fashion. Now, how this, I think, will this will go? One of two ways. What I call the tariff tantrum, I believe, is a strategy to call bullshit on an existing system and break it apart. I think the idea of the global free trade model, that's, we have access to global markets, will break apart. And it's been breaking apart for a while. The Chinese have actually been doing this for years. The Americans are just playing catch up. When you actually look at what the Chinese have actually been doing quietly in the background, most of it's actually not legal, but it's been sort of out of the public eye, right? It's then certain things sort of come into play. If we are indeed in an unconventional warfare situation, incidentally, this is the most effective description of fifth generation warfare I've seen thus far.
Okay, cool. I'll check that
But
out.
I love my books, man.
I can see that. Yep, that's it. I can tell. We can tell.
I could see a situation, for example, that the factions are not based on any particular nationality. There was a civil war in the American system. One faction has now decisively won, but they are both global in nature. We were in a situation, for example, the Ukraine war was being pushed by both the Americans and the British, and it was all about, peace was on the table, but the British Prime Minister went in and scotched that peace. Why? The Anglo petrodollar system, which is managed out of London, cannot allow the Russians to be successful in demanding that their gas is paid for in rubles, which are now not a fiat currency. They're partially backed by physical resources. The moment that happens, and it's allowed to happen, all the debt that all the existing fiat currencies are in they'll crash, and there'll be a flight of capital away from all fiat currencies, away to the commodities currency. The BRICS then nation then release a BRICS dollar, which is backed by commodities. I don't think they're complete yet in backing with commodities, but that's what they're planning to do. Is
Right.
it's to be and I think they're going to use some sort of crypto structure to achieve it. I'm not entirely convinced they've done it yet. So what we've seen thus far might be a stepping stone to what they're really doing. And it won't just be gold, it might be oil as well, it might be gas, whatever. Anyway, it's going to be something like that. So you've got two power blocks. You've got the West and you've got the BRICS. China, Brazil, Russia, India, South Africa. Why is South Africa in there? They produce gold. That's why they're in there. And so they're all commodities-backed groups. So they have most of the industrial systems on the planet between them. Right, so we're looking at a situation where the particular faction that was trying to destroy the BRICS nations has failed, and so the war in Ukraine was the patch of ground that everyone agreed upon to have this battle of wills. It could have been North Korea, South Korea, for example. It could have been
Right.
Iran. It still might. One scenario is that'll breaks apart. Europe fragments. I think the European Central Bank will default on its debt, just like the United States will. Fiat currencies, I believe, will reach a point where we're just going to have a reset. We're seeing treasuries and bonds being dumped now. I'd be astounded if we don't see some really, really big moves in the next couple of weeks. We're seeing them daily anyway.
Yeah. Something's about to break.
Now, they've been trying to get this going for a while. The BRICS economies had the economic strategy. The West finally woke up to what was happening, and the only strategy they had left was to take the conflict kinetic. And that is why I believe they've been aggressively trying to start a kinetic war for years. They've been trying very, very hard. And their behavior, especially in Europe, especially in Ukraine, some of the monkey business that went down there, they're trying to, like, this only happened a couple of months ago, but they got the Americans through NATO, got the Ukrainians to fire a number of missiles into Russian territory. They're at war, to knock out not one but two early warning sites that were early warning. For nuclear strikes. They were taken out. The Russians were now blind to a nuclear strike coming in. At the same time, the Americans had a nuclear capable B-52 doing a training run on St. Petersburg, and they were in the air. You stupid bastards. So what they were trying to do was to antagonize the Russians into doing something stupid. Right? They wanted a war. Finland joined NATO, which I believe was a mistake, but the entire Finnish frontier was about to be deployed like a chess piece.
And so if they did it once, they could try that again. I mean, if they were to the point where they were ready to go that route, then I don't think that that's an ambition that dies easily.
So if they were to do that and it was to work, it would have happened in 2015. I lived in Belgium at the time, so I was right on the front line that was going to come through. I think they've been trying to do it, and there's still a faction in that are still trying to do it. But now that a particular faction has won the knife fight, in the political sphere of America, they've withdrawn from Europe. They're withdrawing from NATO. They're withdrawing from the WHO. They're backing away from all of that, which means if a war was to happen, it won't involve the Americans in Europe. And the rest of the Europeans have not been keeping up with their military spending.
Do you actually believe that, though, that the US is going to abandon NATO or detach itself from NATO?
I think it's a Trumpism where he'll say something outrageous, which is a debate. A negotiating point for a better deal. He's making moves that make it look like he means it, but does he really? I take your point, is what I'm saying. Are they really going to pull out? Because from the point of view of the particular faction, a war would solve so many problems. It would create some problems, but it would solve so many others.
What is your thoughts on the Middle Eastern situation? Do you think there's going to be a war that ensues in the near term, a larger war that includes Iran?
So this is an opinion, and the opinions are they're sort of evolving. One opinion is they've been trying very, very hard to start a war. In fact, the idea to get the Israeli situation to start a third world war has been around for a while. If they were to go and bomb Iran, why would they do that? Now the fact that they've now got two carrier groups in the Red Sea, will they prevail? Probably not, because the naval exercises of, every time the Americans have actually, Scott Ritter talks about this, every time the Americans have actually conducted an exercise where they invade
They've
Iran,
lost.
yes, they cause damage, but they lose. So it's not about winning, it's about starting a war, which could be camouflaged as something else. I do think they've been trying very, very hard to do that. And things have been set in motion, which will be very, very hard to stop. There's a war happening now. I think it's going to be a case of the war will escalate, but I don't think the Americans will be able to commit like they think they're going to commit. They're just not going to be able to do it, which means the people who started that war in the Middle East, is going to happen on a small scale, but everyone involved is going to be hung out to dry, much like what's happened in Ukraine. And so it's going to be very, very ugly, and it's going to show us up as a civilization of who we really are. The real problem's going to be when China takes Taiwan, because the Taiwanese have control of the semiconductor industry, and that's what China really wants. And they're going to do it, and the Americans are going to try and stop them. And so, I believe an under the table deal will be made where they'll let the Chinese take Taiwan. They'll do a bit of saber rattling and they'll race up and down the Pacific and make a good show of it. But in the end, I think the Americans are going to withdraw behind their borders and look at developing their domestic territory, at the same time expanding their domestic territory. So instead of having an invisible empire of the planet, they'll go back to having a physical empire. But things like, let's go take Greenland. What's that all about? That to me is so they can have a major nuclear base, so they can look at the Russians and they can withdraw from Scotland.
Well, and it seems like to add to your point, their ability to project power is going to be diminished. And they will ultimately have to capitulate to the growing spheres of influence of the East, who are just more proximate to all of these, Taiwan, Ukraine, etc. And perhaps the focus is now just going to be on, hey, Venezuela is closer. It's going to be easier. It's lower hanging fruit. Let's conquer South America. I think we're going to be retreating into a more protectionist state of things, and because it's the more economic or energy efficient thing to do, at least at this point in time. So,
Yeah,
but
that's
no, did you have anything else to add
yeah.
there?
I was going to say, imagine if you and I were sitting around the table in the White House or in the Pentagon, and so we've now got an emergency in the United States system. What is it we actually need to go forward? And so if we've lost our global empire, what do we actually need? And so do we really, imagine the Russians doing the same thing. So the Russians are now fighting in Ukraine, but everyone's worried about them invading Europe. But if we're moving into a low energy world, to go and take territory costs resources, and you want to make damn sure you actually want that territory, because it's going to come at a much higher cost now than what it would have, say, 20, 30 years ago. So you can destroy an adversary, but do you really want to take their territory? Is what I believe the Ukraine war is really about. They've been sitting in a defensive line and they've been destroying everything we've sent against them. Right? I don't think the Russians, for example, have any interest in invading the rest of Europe because, why? We don't have anything they want. Not really. And so the Americans are now thinking in the same terms. So how do we remove Chinese influence from our domestic sector? And we are now weakened on the world stage because we're now over our skis and we haven't sort of sorted out an alternative. And so I think the world is going to go into a series of regional states that will then go behind their borders. And it's going to be like that old game Risk, but on a more regional scale. And there are no good guys. And it's going to be based on energy and resources.
So we've talked about the problem. We've talked about some solutions. Where can people find more information about your work? And where should we be? What's a good starting point for people if they want to learn more about what you do?
Okay, so I've got a website, simonmichaud.com, where I haven't updated it for a while, but I'm trying to put all my work up there. My next plan of what the Arcadians could do is about to go onto that website. The idea is to go to South America, find a place that has a lot of industrial pollution, put in that there's a plan to actually put in a reactor park, like a couple of small modular reactors, use that power to power a local mine site very cheaply. They then protect us, and the local government protects us. And then we also use circular economy activities to clean up that industrial waste. While we are there, we then actually develop a new kind of society and a world-class research lab. And I call it, Promethean Nexus.
Okay, well, it sounds like a interesting prototype for a brave new world. Let's hope that it's doesn't emulate the actual novel itself.
Ah, before we sign off, my long-term approach is not to create a utopia, but to create the tools to create multiple options of that utopia in like a horse race scenario, where if one doesn't work, maybe the others will. And as life goes along and things don't go as planned, those tools are handed off to different groups. So you don't have this is the future, it is a utopia, that will fail. What we have is a network of concepts that are handed amongst ourselves, and then the humans will do what humans do.
Yep. Just to kind of set these things in motion so that there's more options when the time presents. Well, we definitely need people like you thinking about these things, being solution focused. It's not enough just to kind of turtle in to our own isolated worlds and realms of things. As a prepper, I've always had trouble reconciling these realities that I don't want to be just a part of the problem in the sense that I'm stagnant in an evolutionary sense. We want to continue to evolve the human species, but when also faced with the imminent crisis that awaits and the imminent crash that awaits, we also need to prioritize, I suppose, just the short-term survival. But we need people like yourself who are going to be thinking of these more broadband solutions to the problem. So I thank you very much for coming on today. And I would encourage people to go and check out more of Simon's work.
I would also encourage people to think that we need people like yourself as well, because you're actually holding the line in an era of difficulty. And your job, your reason to be, is to ensure that we have some kind of human civilization that will survive this. And you could be, you and people like you could make the difference between a dark age or not a dark age. That's not hyperbolic to say that.
Yeah, no, I think
You
there's
think
a
about
definitely a great sense of purpose here, and I thank you for summing it up in that way. But thanks a lot for coming out, Simon. I appreciate it.
The best way to support this channel is to support yourself by gearing up at CanadianPreparedness.com, where you'll find high-quality survival gear at the best prices, no junk, and no gimmicks. Use discount code PREPPINGGEAR for 10% off. Don't forget, the strong survive, but the prepared thrive. Stay safe.